WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The divide between the rich and the poor is widening in America, and that has long concerned our guest this hour. Dr. Francis Fox Piven has written several books about the poor, public welfare, poor people's movements, class warfare, and more. A sociologist, writer, and activist, she has garnered praise from the left while being decried by the right for her views, all of which has left her unfazed. Those views have gotten her a place on Glenn Beck's Tree of Revolution, whatever that is, and she's written a book in response. Who's Afraid of Francis Fox Piven? The Essential Writings of the Professor Glenn Beck Loves to Hate. Dr. Piven is the Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Sociology at the Graduate School and University Center of the City University of New York and is on her way to speak at Winthrop University. She joins us for the hour to talk about this widening gap between rich and poor, how it is impacting our democracy, and more. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
I'm so glad to talk to you, Mike.
From what I understand, you have been an activist and an advocate for the poor almost your entire life. You described your parents as intuitive radicals. Was it them who set the example for you and set you on this path?
Well, they certainly pointed in a certain direction. They made me alert to the deceits of the press, for example. But what they mostly attuned me to was the injustice of some people being very well off, having much more than they could possibly need or use in a reasonable way, and other people suffering from poverty.
You say that your father worked all the time. Was he a grocer? Is that what he was?
He had a small little he rented it, a small little store that sold delicatessen-type things, mm-hmm, and some groceries. And he opened that store at 7 a.m. and closed it maybe at 2 or 3 a.m. to sell another quart of milk.
Wow. And so as a result, you say as a young child, you rarely saw him, but that when you did see him, he'd sit you on his lap and talk about his passion, and his passion was politics. And you were, I think, 4 years old, the story goes, and he's talking to you about politics. What did he tell a four-year-old that you understood and that stuck with you all this time?
Well, he told me, for example, that you couldn't believe everything you read in the newspaper. And then I said, well, Daddy, why do you read the newspaper all the time? And he said, I read between the lines. And being very young, I tried to read between the lines. And I couldn't. I couldn't. And finally, I figured out what he meant.
And your late husband, Dr. Richard Cloward, was the son of a person he described as a radical Baptist minister, and his wife, an artist. Is it safe to say that your husband was also an activist for most of his life from a young age?
Oh, yes, he was. Actually, he was a social worker, and he cared passionately about people at the bottom of the society and the burdens they carried, the obstacles they confronted. And his father was a Northern Baptist minister. And I believe he became toward the end of his life, the official in the Baptist church that was responsible for race and social problems. I don't remember the exact title, but it was something of that sort. So he also grew up in an environment that didn't give him a specific outline of what should be done, but at least attuned him to, oriented him to, the people who were least well off in the society.
Was that what you think what the mutual attraction was there, the fact that you both had this very strong interest in the same thing?
I think so. Especially since we met through our work for what was the first poverty program in the United States, Mobilization for Youth, mm-hmm. a program on the Lower East Side of New York. We were actually working on the problems that we took so seriously.
Talk about that, because that's a program that actually produced benefits. It actually worked.
It did. Well, you know, I think that the poverty program, which is loudly decried by people on the right, the poverty program actually also, in general, it worked. It didn't work perfectly. Nothing works perfectly.
You mean the war? You mean the President Johnson's
war on poverty?
Okay.
Yeah, it had a big impact on poverty in the United States. And when the war on poverty was declared at an end, poverty started to creep up again in our country. And of course, in the last 15 years or so, poverty. And most, I think, shockingly, what we call extreme poverty has been rising. Extreme poverty refers to people who live at one half of the official poverty line. You know, we are world leaders in inequality and extreme poverty. This is so amazing to me. There is no reason that a rich country should tolerate such misery.
Let me throw out some figures that I think you talked about in a speech that you gave or an interview that you gave a little while ago. The U.S. Census Bureau reported in early 2011 that 14.3%, 47 million people, one in six Americans, are living below the official poverty line. Some 19 million are living in what is called extreme poverty. And the Brookings Institution predicts that the poverty rate will increase to nearly 16% by 2016, with 26% of children living in poverty. Those seem like enormous numbers.
Well, they are enormous numbers, and tolerating policies that have that result is really very foolish for the society as a whole. It may not be foolish for the narrow stratum of people, the 1% who are doing so well. But for our society, for our communities, when 26% of kids grow up in miserable conditions where they cannot even think of themselves as part of the community because they don't get crayons, for example, to say nothing of nutritious meals. When that happens, we really tear away at our communal fabric. It's terrible for the children. It's terrible for the rest of us because we are harboring within our communities large numbers of young people who will grow up undereducated, undernourished, and bitter, bitter.
Why do we tolerate this? You say that we lead the world in the numbers of people who are living in poverty and extreme poverty, and you say that these numbers are actually worse than they appear because the United States defines poverty differently than the rest of the world. Talk about that.
Yes. Well, most rich countries define poverty as one half of the median income or one half of the average income. And the reason that's a relative measure. So you're poor if you are living at one half of what the average family is living. And if the average family's income goes up, if everybody does better, then we adjust the poverty rate so that it's the distance from the way most people live that leads to the judgment that you are poor. The significance of that is that it takes account of the importance of material life in how we identify ourselves, whether we can feel that we are part of the sort of great stream of community life, whether we can have the kinds of little dresses if we are a kid that other kids have and things like that. The United States has a very old-fashioned way of measuring poverty. Basically, our poverty measure is calculated from the cost of a kind of market basket of basic foods, and then a multiplier of 3 is applied to the cost of that market basket. So we're using a kind of subsistence measure of poverty, and even by that measure, poverty is increasing in the United States in an unconscionable way.
Why do we do it that way?
Oh, well, we do it that way partly because we've always done it that way, but we also do it that way because in a lot of ways our country is very harsh in and neglectful in its treatment of inequality. This partly has to do with the fact that we're a brash and growing country, or we have been. But it also has to do with, I think, the impact of race and racism on American political culture. You know, for most of our existence, the problem of race and the tensions generated by the fact that we have large numbers of people who are of a different race among us has been very important.
But don't we have a lot of very poor white people? And in fact, don't they outnumber African Americans living in poverty? I could be wrong about that.
Yes.
I'm just asking.
They're about in a sense equal. We have as many whites as we do minorities, or almost as many whites as we do minorities, but the minorities are a much smaller proportion of the overall population.
Okay.
So if they constitute half or more of the poor population, it's disproportionate to their overall numbers.
Okay.
They're more likely to be poor.
You've been working with the poor and writing about the poor and conditions of the poor and poor people's movements for most of your adult and professional life. So what do you understand about the poor in this country that the vast numbers of us out here don't understand?
Well, I suppose one thing I understand is that because I've worked with the poor, I know what they're like. I have friends who are poor. I've always had friends who are poor. I know what their family life is like. I know something about the crises that they confront. I think that a lot of people don't know that because they live in communities where they have very little exposure to poor people. And what exposure they have tends to be very tense and very hostile. They're afraid. A lot of people are afraid of poor people.
Hmm.
So I think that's one difference.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think people are afraid of poor people?
Well, we tend to be afraid of people who are very different from us, or who seem to be very different from us. And we also associate poverty with crime. And, you know, that there's some truth to that when it comes to street crime. But overall, criminality is not concentrated among the poor.
Dr. Francis Fox Piven is our guest, a professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate School and University Center at the City University of New York. She's coming to Winthrop University tomorrow evening to speak about this at 7 o'clock. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds. Purchasing fine jewelry and diamonds March 5th and 6th. Buying and selling fine gems for over 30 years at Sharon Road across from South Park. Details at DonaldHack.com. Well, in recent years, we've witnessed an explosion of direct-to-consumer advertising by drug companies. It's all over the evening news. Every single commercial break, you'll see one of these. But a recently conducted UNC Charlotte study found that commercials in one particular drug category primarily serve the interests of pharmaceutical companies at the expense of the public's interest in genuine health education and welfare. We will delve into that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, what makes U.S. healthcare so expensive? The complex pricing schemes that drive costs, create enormous tax burdens, and bankrupt households.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dr. Frances Fox Piven, who has been working with and writing about the poor in this country for many, many years. Very well thought of on the left and decried on the right. She is speaking tomorrow night at 7 at the DiGiorgio Campus Center at Richardson Ballroom at Winthrop University. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. You mentioned the war on poverty, how it was successful in raising people out of poverty. And yet when it came to an end, and I think it was Bill Clinton who helped bring it to an end with his statement that we are ending welfare as we know it. A lot of people thought at the time that we had created an entitlement class, a dependent class of people, that that's what the war on poverty did. You don't see it that way.
No, I don't see it that way at all. First, the word dependent misleads us because we really should acknowledge that we are all dependent on each other, or that because we live in a society, a community, we are interdependent. That's just the way it is. When Bill Clinton decried welfare dependency, for example, he was most of the people on welfare were kids, little kids. And the other people on welfare were their mothers. Now, we can have an argument about whether it was a good thing for those mothers to go to work, to get a job. I think there are reasonable arguments to be made on both sides of that. But if we were going to push them into work, then I think we were obligated as a society to make sure that the children had childcare, that these little babies were taken care of in a responsible way. We want them to grow up to be fine citizens. That means we have to give them good care. If we're sending their mothers into the workforce, and we're sending their mothers, by the way, into very low-wage jobs, we haven't talked about that at all. We know, for example, that lots of women did go into the workforce after welfare as we know it was ended. But we also know that most of them remained poor, and that means that their children remained poor. We don't know anything about the kind of childcare arrangements that they worked out. It's a very, very patchy system in the United States. By contrast, by the way, most other rich countries do provide for a relatively comprehensive system of childcare. So if we want women, mothers of small children, if we want them to go to work, that might be a reasonable goal for a society. But if we want to do that, we have to make sure that they earn enough to keep their families above the poverty line. We have to make sure that they have childcare facilities so their children are taken care of. We can't just shove them into the workforce without any kinds of supports.
You know a little bit more about this than just simply watching this, observing it, talking to poor people. You went to the University of Chicago at the age of 15 on a scholarship. And once you discovered that you could pass the exams, you stopped going to class and you started taking jobs because they were only paying for your tuition. They weren't paying for your living expenses. You were, what, a waitress and a cocktail waitress and a restaurant waitress?
I did all those things. That's true.
And learned firsthand what it was like to work on minimum wage and below. And this was years ago, but what was it like?
It was hard. But it wasn't so hard for me. I was young and I was strong and so forth. It was, I think what stays in my mind most vividly is how predatory the situation was. The workplaces were, you know, you got a slightly better job as a cocktail waitress instead of a waitress carrying those really heavy trays of full dinners. You were supposed to pay off the head waiter and lots of stuff like that going on. And, I did it. I'm glad I did it. I learned a lot. Maybe I would have learned more if I had stayed in classes, but I eventually caught up in that score too.
Yes. And I think it's ironic, however, that you're a university professor and you weren't a particularly good student, at least the way you approached it. this experience, I know that your father taught you that capitalism was dog eat dog. And what you've just said about your experience as a working person in restaurants and bars kind of confirms that you had to play certain games to get ahead, to get the better shifts, to get the better jobs, to get bigger tips. And that idea stayed with you right through the 1960s. Do you still feel that way about capitalism, that it's dog eat dog?
Oh, I think it is actually more aggressive, more predatory in a bigger way than the head waiter taking a share of your tips. Much more serious now. I think that we can, in a way, get a snapshot on how predatory our economic system is from the way the banks, the financial institutions performed during the ongoing financial crisis. What has basically happened in the years since 2008 is that the money of ordinary Americans, money that they pay in taxes, has been used to bail out the big financial corporations. And they, in turn, they're making big profits now. Mm. Their CEOs have steadily increased their takings, and they want more. They always want more. In a sense, they're making money now by taking it from the rest of us and taking it from the rest of us through tax revenues, taking it from the rest of us through predatory pricing.
And some people say that that is corporate welfare. Others say that this we need to keep these people afloat because they are the, quote, job creators, end quote. And that's the reason we can give corporations breaks when you don't want to give them to poor people, because poor people are lazy. Now, you know, everything I said is not true, but I'm just saying that's what's being said.
That's what's being said. But in fact, one of the problems in the economy and one of the reasons that we haven't had a stronger recovery is that the banks are very reluctant to lend money, to issue credit. And that's partly because they're holding all these soggy mortgages which reflect their another kind of bad behavior in generating those mortgages. But they're not playing the role that they should play to spark a strong recovery.
But could it be argued that a lot of these bad mortgages went to poor people who were trying to live the American dream and somehow found themselves able to get into houses that they couldn't afford? This whole thing was built on a house of cards, not collapsed. Could it be argued that for that brief period of time, those people had it pretty good, the poor people?
Well, they had the dream that we all have, you know. And we don't usually think so, but poor people are very much like the rest of us. If the rest of us dream about having our own home with a little white picket fence, so do poor people want their own home with a little white picket fence. And when in a sense, the opportunity was offered them, but in a way that allowed the most unregulated and predatory issuing of mortgages, so that people took out mortgages which very quickly escalated, the monthly payments escalated because the interest rates jumped up and they couldn't conceivably afford it. They were misled into taking out those mortgages. Now, I know that I find it not only a pain in the neck, but a real chore to try to read the fine print in the various financial documents that I get. And now we are chastising poor people for not having read the fine print. And we also know that the lending companies like what was it called?
Countrywide.
That they cut corners. They didn't take the precautionary measures that they were supposed to take. They encouraged people to take out mortgages that they could not afford.
So in many cases, I think it could be easily argued that these big banking institutions acted irresponsibly and not in the public interest, and not even really in the interest of their own shareholders, as it turns out. But as long as we're talking about responsibility, let's go back to the poor. I'm going to ask you a very simple but an impossibly difficult to answer question. Why are the poor poor? They've always been with us. The poor, they've always been poor people in the world. Why are they poor? Why are they undereducated? We in this country give people a free education through high school. Why do some people leave high school or drop out of high school unable to read and write? Why?
Well, there are several answers to that question. In the first place, I don't think it's correct to say the poor have always been with us and every country has its poor. Most rich countries have reduced poverty and reduced poverty significantly. So we have more poor, for example.
How have they reduced poverty?
Well, they've reduced poverty partly by making sure that the minimum wage is a wage that people can subsist on. They've reduced poverty by with programs that favor, for example, single parents, give them housing subsidies. Or they've reduced poverty with something that in some countries is called the family wage. And that is a government subsidy to all families who are raising children. They have a national health care system, which is essentially free. And they have subsidized housing. I mean, those are all different. And I'm not talking about countries that we would call socialist. I'm talking about Sweden and Norway and Denmark and Germany and France. These are countries that have a good, strong safety net. Now, that safety net is at risk right now because of the austerity crisis in Europe. But for a very long time, since the end of World War II, a lot of people in the rich countries have been supported in a way, but does that make them dependent? I don't think so. I think these are the kinds of supports which allow people to work, allow them to get an education, allow them to become healthy and contributing citizens. So if we condemn that, if we tarnish that by calling them dependent, I think we are giving ourselves a hot foot.
But what about responsibility? We do give children an education from first through 12th grade here, free of charge. Sometimes if you excel in those areas, you can go to right through college and graduate school on scholarships free of charge. Not everyone can do that, of course, but it is possible to do. If you don't make minimum wage, should you have children? Should you not take it upon yourself to delay that until you make enough money to have children and support those children?
Well, you've asked a number of questions altogether.
Right.
One about our educational system. And we do know, everybody knows, that our educational system is very uneven, that because we depend essentially on local tax revenues for education, the K through 12 educational system is pretty good in affluent communities and is pretty rotten in poor communities. Mm-hmm. That's part of it, but it's not the whole of it. Education is not something that occurs only in school. When children are raised in communities that are blanketed with despair, they're going to look around them and see that the adults in the community are not doing well. And that's going to depress, dampen the aspirations of the children as well.
Is that exacerbated by their exposure to media, in which they see clearly how the other half can live and does live in many cases?
I think, you know, from my interaction with students of all kinds, I think it produces a kind of craziness so that young children, say in middle school, if you ask them, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And what do you expect when you grow up? Well, they expect everything because they watch it on TV. And at the same time, they know because they watch their uncles and their aunts and their neighbors that there's something very unlikely about the dream that they harbor. So there's this vast distance between their dreams and their reality. And that's not good for a society.
But people do make it out of poverty. They do achieve dreams. They do go from rags to riches. It has happened many, many, many times before. You can look at examples almost anywhere. So how do you explain that? Is it just the personal initiative of somebody? Is it luck? Is it looks? What is it?
Well, all sorts of contingencies and accidents. It may be that a child is favored by a teacher who takes an interest in the home life of the child, worries when the child comes to school in dirty clothes and does something about it. I mean, it may be something of that sort. It may be a kindly neighbor. It may be a community center that the child goes to where an adult takes some responsibility for the well-being of the child. All those sorts of things, those, you know, sort of accidents of life can make a difference. But I think that we should be careful about the idea that kids can rise from poverty through mobility. The mobility rates in the United States are very low compared to other countries.
Dr. Frances Fox Piven, our guest. We have to take a break. We will come back with more in just a moment. And we have a lot of people hanging on and wanting to talk about this and sending emails and comments on the web. We'll get to those as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com. And North Carolina Dance Theater presenting Jean-Pierre Bonfou's Peter Pan, Escape to Neverland, with this high-flying ballet with new sets and costumes March 7th through 17th at Knight Theater. Tickets at ncdance.org. What makes U.S. healthcare so expensive? Understanding the complex pricing schemes that drive up costs, create an enormous tax burden, and bankrupt households. That's the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Coming right back.
No spring pledge drive? You could make it happen. Once again, we are encouraging you to pledge early to eliminate days of our 10-day spring membership campaign. Last fall, thanks to you, we were able to reduce the drive by half. Can you imagine eliminating more? It's possible when you go online and contribute at WFAE.org and make your pledge. The clock is ticking, so help us make history by taking even more days off our upcoming fun drive. Thanks for making your pledge today.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Frances Fox Piven, our guest today, speaks tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the DiGiorgio Campus Center Richardson Ballroom at Winthrop University. Details on that on our website at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're talking about poverty in America today and about poor people, and I'm going to go to the phones and read some emails here in a second, but I know that you learned early on about the power of people to work cooperatively for change. In other words, pooling your resources and becoming organized, essentially, and working toward whatever goal it is. That's the theory behind unions. How has the decline in the importance of and the power of unions impacted poor people?
Has it had a very large impact? And it's the fact that unions have themselves been under assault by employer interests, and also by the government of the United States for much of the time since the peak of unionism in the 1950s, means that we no longer have a powerful lobbying presence in the United States of the AFL-CIO unions, which actually defended poor people. They defended programs that poor people rely upon, like unemployment insurance, like food stamps, like Medicaid. We owe to the unions and their lobbying strength the fact that these programs have even persisted. But with unions as battered as they are now, less than 7% of the of the American workforce is now unionized. With unions so battered, we've lost this force in our national politics. So that leaves most ordinary Americans, in a sense, exposed to the lobbying power of business interests.
This is happening at the same time. You just brought this up, that corporations have been declared people by the Supreme Court, and that influence is seen mostly in our elections to date. But you're right, they do lobby Congress. They have a very powerful voice, whereas the rank and file, the voters, seem to be being diminished, rich and poor voters, unless they use their interests as a corporate stockholder, are being diminished. Is this what you're talking about? As the poor become greater in number, this is what the danger to democracy is?
This is a very big danger to democracy. It's always been the case that democracy has been threatened by the flow of money into the electoral process. And at certain times in our history, that fact has had horrific consequences. For a very long time, for example, unions were outlawed and strikes were outlawed. And this was a reflection of the lobbying power of the robber barons in the 19th century. But we're in that kind of situation again today. The inequality that we talked about in the earlier segment means not only more poverty, but it means that the fortunes accumulated by the tiny minority of the very rich are huge. And a lot of that money gets poured into politics and political influence. The consequences are that in democracy and the policies produced by democracy, instead of modifying the inequalities generated by the market economy, are contributing, these policies are contributing to those inequalities.
And in the South, unions never really caught on. In fact, they didn't catch on in many cases, in most cases, because the rank-and-file worker didn't want them here. They saw them as unfair, taking their money from them for union dues, etc. And they were fought against by the workers themselves, people fighting against their own economic self-interest, which continues today in the voting booth in some cases. But why do you think that happens?
Well, you know, actually the history of the South and unions is very troubled, very complicated. There have been periods in the South when ordinary working people fought bitterly for the right to unionize and were crushed. They were beaten up. Some of them were killed. And the fledgling unions were smashed. This was true, for example, of efforts to unionize the textile industry in the late 1920s. Miners in the South who have tried to unionize have also been suffered brutal forms of repression. So, you know, and this historical experience, I think, contributes to a sense that unions are just trouble. That you can only make things worse if you try to improve your circumstances through collective action. Which I think is a pretty widespread attitude in parts of the South.
Let me bring some people into this conversation who have been listening to our guest today, Dr. Francis Fox Piven. Let's begin with Wally in Charlotte. You're on WFAE, Wally.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm calling. I believe at the base of all that we're discussing in regard to poverty is moral questions. And I believe, as such, it has to be explained from a spiritual point of view. I believe greed is the base of all of it.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I agree also that the moral issue is excessive greed, and it's also a sort of – it's the question of whether we are our brother's and our sister's keeper. It's the question of whether we take some responsibility for the well-being of the children who are born into misery, into poverty, into disorganization. And it is a moral question. The moral question of whether it is right that a narrow stratum of people, maybe one-tenth of the top 1%, want more and more and are taking more and more and more. And they're taking not only more and more of the productivity of our economy, but they're also using their influence to take the revenues that are contributed by other people to the public sector.
Now, they will tell you that they earned it. So what do you say to that?
I think that this is so crazy. I recall a talk I gave, I think, at Florida State University a few years ago. And I talked about poverty in that talk. And there were, you know, the students lined up at the mic afterwards, and not the women students. The women students didn't do this, but the guys, they all said, oh, I earned it. I take care of myself. I'm independent. I don't rely on government. And here they are at a state university. They don't even know it. People don't recognize the extent to which they rely on public supports to keep our communities safe, to keep them clean, to regulate traffic. I took the subway down to the studio where I'm recording this, and that subway is a public service. Everybody uses in New York. Everybody uses the subway. Yet a lot of people don't recognize that that's a collective responsibility.
We've actually lost that in this society today. If you listen to the political conversation, that we've lost the idea that we're all in this together, that we are in a collective of sorts in this country. And you bring this up in a statement I think you made a couple of years ago. You say, if the trends of the last 30 or 40 years are not halted and reversed, and those trends include increasing inequality, a crumbling public life, a disintegrating public infrastructure, which are the bridges and roads and electric grid and sewer systems and things like that, an exhausted ecology, and a huge war arsenal and more war making, then you're pretty gloomy about the prospects for the American future and the harm that this country can do to the world, you say.
And the harm that we can do to ourselves. You know, the planet is at risk as a consequence of what Wally called greed. You know, more and more and more and more. We have to produce more and more. Everybody wants more stuff. We can't sustain an economy of that kind and continue to live on this planet. I wouldn't call myself pessimistic.
Okay.
I think that I see these trends and they fill me with foreboding. But I'm also keenly aware that there have been other times in our history when people did, in a certain sense, grasp the situation and force reforms. And I think this may be a period of that kind. You know, across the globe, people are rising up, and they're rising up against the depredations of a capitalist economy that is out of control. Capitalism requires regulation, or it's going to do a lot of damage. And that regulation has been worn away by the power, the political power of capitalists. But, you know, people in Latin America have been rising up, and they have successfully changed their governments. There are improved public policies in places like Brazil and Bolivia and Chile. The students in Quebec had a very long and tenacious strike, and they forced a reduction in tuition and fees. I think that there also is this the gloomy prospect of the trends that are now ongoing, and there is the hope that people will grasp the situation and force a reversal of these trends.
I want to go back to the phones, but the closest thing that we've come to in this country with regard to that kind of a populist movement was both the Tea Party movement, which seems to have been very successful on the right, and the Occupy movement, which lasted for just a few brief short months, burned brightly, and then flickered out. So what does that say about people who want justice where they see injustice versus those who want more?
Well, you know, I don't think either the Tea Party or Occupy are actually over. It may be that the events that we associate with those names are over, but the Tea Party actually was a reincarnation of earlier movements like the Patriots or the Militia, mm-hmm. or whatever. And Occupy also is taking new forms. I spent yesterday morning with a group of occupiers. They call themselves Occupy, but they're working in Far Rockaway and Sunset Park at the bottom of Brooklyn, and they're working with the community. What they're trying to do is they're trying to spur collective efforts in the Rockaways to repair the community, which was badly hit by Hurricane Sandy. And they feel that they're growing roots in those communities, and that they are they're exemplifying a belief in cooperation, and that this is the beginning of a politics of community organization, they would call it.
Robert on Facebook writes, would you say you worry about job-killing taxes and bloated government as about 50% of the fear-mongering electorate in North Carolina worry? And would you comment on Ayn Rand's capitalist views or your father's views if you ever discussed Rand?
No, we never discussed Ayn Rand. I didn't really learn about Ayn Rand till I went away to college. I think Ayn Rand is nuts. I really do. I am awestruck by the fact that what might be called intelligent people are entranced by Ayn Rand's philosophy, which is, I've got mine and I want more. And that's right, because I'm better than everybody else. That's the philosophy. That's not a philosophy that's widely held in the United States, but it is, to the extent that it's held by those who are in positions of great influence at the peak of our economy and our politics, it's very dangerous.
I have a minute left, and Carolyn tweets, what would it cost to close the gap or end poverty? And can we currently afford it while everyone cuts back?
Oh, of course we can afford it. For one thing, if we close the poverty gap, we would also have many more productive individuals, the children who are now being greatly harmed by the poor conditions in which they live. We are a very rich country. We 93% of the increase in our productivity went to the top 1%. That is not good for the society, and that's what we have to stop.
Dr. Frances Fox Piven, who is with the City University of New York and has written many, many books on the topic of poor people and poverty and poor people's movements and more. She speaks tomorrow evening at 7 at Winthrop University. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey.